There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth and every common sight to me did seem, apparelled in celestial light, the glory and freshness of a dream. So I want to begin with quite a long reading. So it's about two sides of A4, so you might want to get comfortable. And it's from the 1924 novel by Mary Webb called Precious Fane. And it's to set the scene of the beauty of nature. I never knew, nor do I know now, why corn shines thus in the nights of July and August, keeping a moonlight of its own, even when there is no moon. But it is a marvellous thing to see, when the great hush of full summer and deep night is upon the land, till even the aspen tree, that will ever be gossiping, durst not speak, but holds breath as if she waited for the coming of the Lord. There were things I waited for, as a wench waits for her sweetheart at her edge of the forest. This rippling and shining of the corn was one, and another was the marvellous sight of dragonflies coming out of their bodies. We had a power of dragonflies at Sarn, of many kinds and colours, little and big, that every one was bound in due season to climb up out of its watery grave and come out of its body, with a great labour and pain, and a torment like the torment of childbirth, and a rending like the rending of the tomb. That was the best time of year for our lake. All round stood the tall trees, thick-leaved with rich summer green, unstirring, caught in a spell. All around the lake stood the tall bulrushes. Within the ring was another ring of lilies. And at this time of the year, they were the most beautiful thing at Sarn, and the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. The big bright leaves lay calm upon the water, and calmer yet upon the leaves lay the lilies, white and yellow. When they were buds, they were like white and gold birds sleeping, head under wing, or like summit carven out of glistering stone, or they were like gouts of pale wax. But when they were come into full blow, they were not like anything but themselves. And they were so lovely, you couldn't choose but cry to see them. The yellow ones had more of a spread of petals, having five or six apiece. But the white ones opened their four wider, and each petal was bigger. The petals are of a glistening white within, like the raiment of those men who stood with Christ upon the mountaintop. And without, they're stained with tender green, as if they'd taken colour from the green shadows in the water. Some of the dragonflies look like this also, for their lacy wings without other colour are sometimes touched with shifting green. So the mere was three times ringed about, as if it had been put three times in a spell. First there was the ring of oaks and larches, willows and alum trees and beeches, solemn and strong, to keep the world out. Then there was the ring of rushes, sighing thinly, brittle and sparse, but enough with their long trembling shadows to keep the spells in. Then there was the ring of lilies, as I said, lying there as if Jesus, walking upon the water, had laid them down with his cool hands, before he turned to the multitude, saying, "Behold the lilies." And if they were not enough to shake your soul, there beneath every lily, white and green or pale gold, was her bright shadow, as it had been her angel. And through the long, untroubled days, the lilies and their angels looked one upon the other and were content. So I grew up in the Midlands, in a small town, and we moved there from London when I was about two. And in those days, it was quite a wild place, with woods and spinneys and ponds and streams and seemingly endless fields. My father would take my sister and I on these long walks across the countryside, over fences and through streams. So we'd be trailing far behind, and he'd be up ahead, not really wanting to engage with us, apart from to occasionally mention that little girls should be seen but not heard. But I remember experiencing such quiet joy, because the beauty of the world was all around us. I remember once my father happened to come back and look for me, and virtually happened to drag me away from the sight of the sunset reflected in a pool of water. To me, it was a mirror skin of light, and it inspired in me feelings of near religious devotion. So I read and wrote a lot of poetry as a child, and one day when I was about nine, I picked up a book called The Ring of Words. And on the cover it said, "Bright is the ring of words when the right man rings them." And when you opened it, inside there was a kind of line drawing of a sort of shining land, and these lines by Wordsworth: "The earth and every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light." And these words spoke to my heart so deeply, it was like finding a mirror for my soul. So what is the celestial light? Carl Jung said that the longing for light is the longing for consciousness. In his lecture, The Secret Life of the Love Song, Nick Cave says, "We all experience within us an inexplicable longing, an unnamed and enigmatic yearning of the soul, the desire to be transported from darkness into light, to be touched by the hand of that which is not of this world." So we long for the celestial light, but it's hard to experience the celestial light directly. We usually need to experience it through something earthly. And the ways we most easily experience it are through nature, through the arts, and through falling in love. So Rumi says, "The beloved is all, the lover just a veil. Yet the light of the beloved is only revealed to us through the veil. As above, so below. The earth and the celestial light are not separate. And yet there is an immortality that we intuit, this inexplicable longing." And so it makes me think of the bodhicitta, of something which somehow exists outside of the five skandhas, something not of this world. And Banti has compared the arising of the bodhicitta to the experience of the descent of the Holy Spirit. And beauty, real beauty, is like that, the momentary flash of the feeling of the descent of the Holy Spirit. So beauty is kind of a fourth sight, showing us that there is something beyond that which we perceive with our physical senses alone. As a child, nature's beauty was my religion. So when I became older, I became a pagan, which basically entailed a lot of naked dancing under the full moon, as did Butterfield. And in my 20s, I became an activist because I saw that the natural world was under threat. And then I found the Dharma. Keats said, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty." And so sometimes we see beauty in unlikely places. Impermanence is truth. And so sometimes when we see impermanence, we see beauty. And sometimes it's not obvious at all why beauty is suddenly present. So I'd like to share a couple of experiences of being suddenly transported by the art. The first happened when I hadn't been meditating for very long. I walked into a room where someone was playing a tape of Miserere, this sort of really beautiful choral music. They used to play it in the Sistine Chapel. And the moment I walked into the room and heard this music, my state of consciousness was so completely transformed that I thought, God, I'm enlightened. When I'd asked Jairaja how long he thought it'd take me to get ordained, he looked at me and goes, 10 years. It's actually 15. And here I was, just completed part one Buddhism and profound samadhi. So eventually, after a few hours, I realised that I wasn't enlightened because I asked myself, do I know anything now that I didn't know before? And I didn't. But the experience lasted for about 12 hours. Another time, I was walking under the viaduct in Brighton, listening to Patti Smith on the headphones. And the viaduct is really quite a dark place. Two streams of full-on traffic. There's an island in the middle where people dump old mattresses and bottles and cans. And there's kind of a netting up in the roof where birds sometimes get caught and die, and they just remain hanging there. And it's one of the areas of the most concentrated pollution in Brighton. But on this particular day, Patti comes on the headphones, and she's singing, all is glowing, all is knowing. I am the spring, the holy ground, the endless seed of mystery, the thorn, the veil, the face of grace. And suddenly the viaduct is transformed into a cathedral. The columns supporting the roof suddenly look like the columns of a Greek temple. The stone archways suddenly look like the windows of great churches. The celestial light was suddenly in everything, and it was like the Ginsberg poem. Holy the solitudes of skyscrapers and pavements. Holy the cafeterias filled with the millions. Holy the mysterious rivers of tears under the streets. Holy the lone juggernaut. So the viaduct still looks like a cathedral to me some days. But I would never walk under there with my child because of the traffic pollution. So sometimes we have to look beyond our subjective experience, no matter how elevated, to really see the truth of interconnectedness. Because the truth of interconnectedness is not always immediately obvious. For example, one of the amazing facts I've learnt this year is that half the Earth's oxygen is made by plankton. So there's a quote by Professor Guy McPherson. If you really think the environment is less important than the economy, try holding your breath while you count your money. Things are interconnected. The Earth and the celestial light are not separate. So when I talked to Banti about 5 years ago about climate change, we agreed that even though all things are impermanent, it's still worth trying to do something to prevent suffering. And climate change is set to cause suffering on a scale never before witnessed by human beings. And it's happening now. In A Blueprint for a New Society, Banti said, the world I have in mind is an entirely new world, a world radically different from the old one. This new world will be a world in which we relate to one another as individuals, a world in which we are free to develop to the utmost of our potential, and in which the social, economic, and political structures will help us to do that. So that last line, in which the social, economic, and political structures will help us to do that. So we've just ended up with a government who is intent on hurting the poor and taking away benefits from disabled people, stripping us of our freedom of speech, and who have no intention of doing anything to prevent catastrophic global warming. We could think of politics as really being the same as ethics. If we really want to see a more ethical world, we need to have more political involvement than just voting once every 5 years. When I visited Banti and we talked about climate change, we talked about the Green Party, and Banti suggested that I could invite Caroline Lucas to come and speak at the Brighton Buddhist Centre. So we did that in Brighton, and it was very well attended, but somehow it didn't translate into more Buddhists getting out there and leafleting. Some years ago, I saw a film about people escaping from Tibet across the Himalayas, and two of these young Tibetan guys were at the screening, because there was a questions and answers session afterwards. And so at a certain point, this voice comes from the back of the cinema. As a fellow Dharma practitioner, I wonder, did your practice of the Dharma help you during your arduous journey? So these two Tibetan guys look at each other for a moment, and then one of them says, no. it depends on what you mean by practicing the Dharma, because these guys were obviously practicing fearlessness and generosity and so on. But it illustrates a point that when people are caught up with just trying to survive, it's very hard to think of anything higher. And in extremes of deprivation, it's maybe even hard to keep the first precept. So there's always a lot of talk about this idea of trying to keep below a 2-degree rise in temperature. But if we read the small print, you'll find that it's actually impossible to keep below a 2-degree rise now. We would need to use geoengineering to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And as yet, the technology to do this does not exist. And the political willpower to create that technology does not exist. So the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their business as usual trajectory, whereby we continue to burn significant amounts of fossil fuels, and we continue to strip the land to make way for cattle, for meat and dairy, and to grow the food for cattle, puts us on course for a rise this century of between 3.7 and 4.8 degrees. So at 2 degrees, the Great Barrier Reef ecosystem will collapse. At 3 degrees, the Amazon ecosystem will collapse. And we're talking about a rise of 3.7 to 4.8, not in 200 years, but this century. Even without a dramatic temperature change, we're now experiencing what is being called the sixth mass extinction. So even groups like the World Wildlife Fund are now talking in terms of the sixth mass extinction. We're destroying habitat and polluting oceans at such a rate that we're set to experience the collapse of all our major ecosystems this century. We're destroying the topsoil at such a rate that we have between 60 and 100 harvests left before it's all gone. So we need to change the way in which we live. We need to learn to live more sustainably. So I emailed Banti a year or so ago saying, Banti, I need help trying to spread the climate change message because I need to be able to influence the people that can make changes. And Astvajit emailed me back saying, Banti sends you his blessing. And he suggests you might also read his poem, An Apology, out loud every day. So I've been doing that for about 14 months now. I think I've only forgotten four times. So I'd like to read that for you now. An Apology, Ergyen Sangharakshita. We live in the age of apologies. Here is an apology that is much more meaningful than many being made today. Mankind owes a profound apology to the birds for polluting the air through which they fly, to the ape and the tiger for having destroyed the forests in which they live, to the deer and the bison for ruthlessly hunting them almost to extinction, to the rivers and streams for poisoning them with chemicals, to the earth itself for greedily pillaging its riches of silver and gold, to the oceans for slaughtering the greatest of her children, the whale, for scientific purposes, to the mountain peaks for defiling their virgin snows with our trash, to the moon for rudely invading her sacred space, to the stars for obscuring their brightness with the smoke of our cities, to the sun for not gratefully acknowledging our dependence on his bounty, to the truly great men and women of the past for not honouring their memory as we should and for not walking in their footsteps. I'm a mother, and like all children, my child will say things to me like, when I grow up, I want to be this. Or when I grow up, I want to do that. And it's the most heartbreaking thing you can imagine, looking down into this beautiful little face that's so full of hope and dreams, and knowing that the future that we're creating is almost certainly going to be one of food and water shortages and social breakdown. So how can we respond? I guess ethics isn't really about assuming a particular end result. It's about doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. So to this end, I think the right thing to do would be if we could get all our public centres committed to moving towards sustainability. Probably the easiest way to get that to happen is for the chair of each centre to put in a proposal to their trustees. And once you've actioned the 10 points on the Sustainable Buddhist Centre Action Plan, Amalaketu will give you a lovely certificate. But I think that as well as that, we do, as a movement, need to update our thinking around ethics to reflect the realities of the 20th century. We need information about the consequences of our actions in order to have the opportunity to make better choices. Because instead of financing the fossil fuel and nuclear industries, we could change our domestic energy suppliers to renewable energy, like ecotricity or good energy. Instead of financing the suffering of living beings in the dairy industry, we could explore veganism. We need to be aware that if we are buying cheap high street clothing, then we're likely buying into the suffering of other people on the other side of the world, and maybe even into the suffering of children. We could reflect on the idea that politics and ethics are indivisible, and that the creation of a fairer world is the responsibility of us all. So this might be a bit radical, but I think we could do with a paper to the whole order on ethics for the 21st century. It must be time for another paper. And I know loads of amazing order members who would contribute to such a paper, and it could transform the ethics of the whole Sangha. There's a lot of support in the order for the idea of us becoming a sustainable community in the way the Quakers have done. But though I receive a lot of personal correspondence about the climate change thread in Shabda, and though people are always telling me how much they appreciate it, not many people feel they want to contribute to the thread. So the thread doesn't really represent the amount of desire for change that there is in the order. And it seems that we don't really have the structures in place to be able to make collective decisions. A couple of years back, I texted 5 or 6 friends who I know care deeply about the environment, and I just asked them, would they be up for supporting the climate change thread and just adding to it? And I said, you know, I know that it does take balls or fanny to stick your head above the parapet. I spoke to Dharma Bandhu a couple of weeks later, and he said, what happened last with the climate change thread? Did people stick their fannies above the parapet? One other possibly radical suggestion. I wonder if we could change a line in the Sevenfold Puja. So there's a line that says, just as the earth and other elements are serviceable in many ways. So it's referring to the element of earth. But everyone I've spoken to does visualise the earth. And I just wonder what effect that has on us to continually visualise the earth and say that it is serviceable. So the equivalent line from Shanti Deva's version is, just like space and the great element such as earth, may I always support the life of all the boundless creatures. So I was part of Buddhafield in the early days, and I used to love travelling to Buddhafield with Vishvadarkani, because we always used to have a little adventure along the way. And one time we stopped off at Stonehenge in the evening sunlight. I don't know if you still can, but in those days, if you really stretched your arm through the fence, you could touch the heel stone. So we'd stopped off at the heel stone to smoke our last bit of dope. Because being on retreat meant no drugs for a week, usually. And we had the car door open so we could listen to the stereo. And we were listening to Bounty's lecture, Nature, Man and Enlightenment. So I'd like to read you a quote from that talk. So this is Bounty. We're being warned that certain natural resources are finite and that we're using them all up at an alarming rate. More often than not only using them up at an alarming rate, but using them in a most wasteful fashion. So Buddhists, those who try to follow the Dharma, should be very aware of this and should try to use everything of natural origin very carefully indeed. Not only that, but use as little of it as possible and use it in the best possible way. That is to say, for the benefit, the true benefit, of self and others. The same principle applies to our use of the natural environment. We shouldn't destroy it or spoil it in any way, as for instance through pollution. And above all, we should think very carefully before bringing about irreversible changes. So earlier I was talking about the bodhicitta, and when the bodhicitta arises, we become a bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva vows to save all beings from suffering. I remember when I first came across the bodhisattva vow, Jayaraja had given me Vasantra's book, Meeting the Buddhas, to read. And it was a really hot, stormy night, and I had my window open, and a hot wind was blowing into my room. And then I found it, the bodhisattva vow. And as soon as I read about it, I knew that my search for the highest beauty was over. This was the highest thing in the universe. This was the Holy Grail. And as I was sitting there, one of my sort-of boyfriends threw a white rose up through my open window. So suddenly, out of nowhere from the storm, appears this white rose. And that was like finding the bodhisattva vow. But I'm not a bodhisattva. When I visited Bante 5 years ago, I said, Bhante, I've been practicing quite a long time now, but I've still got quite a lot of greed and hatred. And Bhante goes, yes. And that was the time we talked about climate change. And we said that even though all things are impermanent, it's still worth trying to prevent suffering. And it was funny because while we were talking, I had a sort of vision. It was sort of in the distance above Bhante's shoulder. It was kind of like a parade of people with parasols and elephants. And I remember thinking, it's the mock show, the apparitional world of appearances. But I came out of that meeting knowing that I wanted to be one of the people in Tri Ratna helping us to move towards sustainability in response to suffering. So I've given Bhante flowers 3 times. First was many years ago at Buddha Field. The meadow was due to be cut. So I picked a bunch of wildflowers and I put them in a jam jar for Loka Bandhu to take back to Madhima Loka. The second time was when Bandhu came to Brighton and Mike Pradarshan gave me flowers from his flower shop to give to Bandhu. And the third time was 5 years ago when we talked about climate change and Bandhu blessed my Tara Rupa. He looked down at Tara and said, oh yes. And I gave Bandhu lilacs from my garden. Me and Apeksha Devi had to carry them on the escalator on the underground, this little vase, and we had them on the train on the table in between us, and the taxi driver rejoiced in them. But as soon as I entered Bante's room, I was immediately hit by the perfume of lilies, and I suddenly felt that my own offering was so poor, and my own soul was so poor. And Bante took the lilacs, and he said, oh, these are very fine. And suddenly I felt like a little flower, unexpectedly shone on by the sun. So I'm at the end of my talk now. I have one more reading for you. And the flower that I want to offer today is that white rose in the storm, the flower of the bodhisattva vow. May we all fulfill that vow. And may the world of beauty and green things always be touched with the celestial light. And may we help to make it so. So my reading is from The Thread of Gold, written by Arthur Benson in 1907, and the reading is called The Flower. I have made friends with a new flower. It lives in my mind, a perfect and complete memory of brightness and beauty, and, as I have said, a friend. It was in a steep sea cove that I saw it. The plant had light brown branches, which were now all starred with the greenest tufts imaginable. But the flower itself, on many of the bushes, it was not yet fully out, and showed only in an abundance of small lilac balls carefully folded. But just below me, a cluster had found the sun and air too sweet to resist, and had opened to the light. The flower was a delicate veined purple, a five-pointed star with a soft golden heart. All the open blossoms stared at me with a tranquil gaze, knowing I would not hurt them. And I forgot all my busy schemes and hopes and aims. the tiny part I play in the world, with so much petty energy, such anxious responsibility. My purple-starred flower approved of my acquiescence, smiling trustfully upon me. Here, it seemed to say, I bloom and brighten, spring after spring. No one regards me. No one cares for me. No one praises my beauty. No one sorrows when these leaves grow pale, when I fall from my stem, when my dry stalks whisper together in the winter wind. But to you, because you have seen and loved me, I whisper my secret. Thank you.